Welcome back to Better Than I Found It, the podcast all things college golf. You're listening to Mike McGraw, the men's golf coach at Baylor University. Today's very special guest is not a golfer. Instead, it will be master painter David LaFell, who also happens to be my brother-in-law. David and my third oldest sister, Sherry, live and paint in Taos, New Mexico, and have for years. David, considered by many a modern master in realism, discusses his unique and challenging childhood and how that led him to a life in painting. I believe that success leaves clues, and that is the case with David. Excellence, in my mind, looks different on everyone, but you know it when you see it. In this episode, David and I discuss the parallels between painting and golf. I mean, after all, golf is, in a sense, art, isn't it? I hope you enjoy. Okay, Better Than I Found It listeners, it's time to welcome my first non-golfer in a while to the podcast. Please join me in welcoming master painter David LaFell to the podcast today. David, I'm truly honored that you would spend some time with me today.
Well, I'm just as honored, Michael, to be interviewed by you.
Well, I mean, you know, I've had a couple of non-golfers on here. One of them was John Smith, who is the only person in history to win 6 world championships in wrestling in a row. I mean, 2 Olympic golds. And he did a great job, I thought, of kind of relating what he did to become the world's best in wrestling to how golfers could do the same thing. You know, I know you don't want to hear this, but I consider you like, I don't know, a master modern day art painter in realism. I think a lot of people consider you that. So I'm not trying to stroke your ego or anything, but it's like you have really been amazing all these years. And I have just been honored to know you all these years. You know, my sister Sherry and you go way back, obviously. Anyway, it's exciting to have you on today, and thank you for doing this. You know, with most of my guests, I like to go back to the beginning. So when they're young, kind of when, you know, dreams are forged and, you know, you really don't know where you're going or what you're doing, but you grew up a young boy in Brooklyn, New York. That in and of itself isn't that unusual. A lot of people come from Brooklyn, but not very many people spend basically 12 years in the hospital in Brooklyn as a young boy. So tell me about that story at age 4, kind of going into the hospital and spending all those years there.
Well, I don't really remember too much from 4 to 7. I came home for 1 year from 7 to 8. And that's when my memory really started to kick in, or has kicked in. So from 8 to 15 and a half or 16, I was in the hospital. And basically, it was kind of a good thing because it gave me a lot of self-sufficiency. You had to fend for yourself. In one sense, Michael, it was the kids against the nurses. So that was one aspect of survival. And the other, I think that influenced my life later on, there was no authority. I had no authority figure to look up to. So I started to question everything and everybody. And I think that became an important factor in my later life of finding out for myself. When I got into painting, I had to find out for myself all the so-called basics, what worked, what didn't work. So, well, in one sense, people would think it was a very tragic, suffering kind of beginning. It actually wasn't for me.
Well,
I didn't know any other life, so it was very natural.
It was, but I had never heard you actually tell that story. I just always knew that it happened. Sherry had always told me that had been your childhood. I've seen this drawing in person, and it's iconic to me. But apparently, somebody had brought you a magazine
with Joe DiMaggio's picture on the cover. And I've seen that at your house, but that's the most amazing drawing. How in the world did a kid in a hospital bed draw that? Talk about that. Do you remember drawing it? I'm sure.
Yes. Well, there were other children in the hospital, of course, who could draw. And there was actually one boy in particular, Eddie Green, who was 4 years older than myself. And he was always better than me. He was like a so-called, as good as I could draw, Eddie could draw better. And but as I said, one beneficial aspect of being in the hospital was there was plenty of time to draw, copy comic books, copy anything, make up comic books, you know, or as you said, with the drawing of Joe DiMaggio, we'd get good photographs of people we liked, and we try to copy them as accurately as possible. So that was a large part of my hospital stay, was drawing.
Have you ever thought about drawing that same drawing again as a seasoned artist that you've been doing it for all these years? Have you ever thought about redoing that paint, that drawing?
Redoing that drawing?
Yeah.
Well, that was as good as I could do. I guess around 12 or 13 years old when I did it.
It was stunning because I actually saw that drawing and it looks just like what was on the cover of that magazine. Pretty amazing. And being a New York guy, that was an iconic figure to draw, wasn't it?
Well, he was my hero. He was my idol at the time.
Yeah, he was awfully good. I don't think the kids from this generation have any clue what a great baseball player is. You'd have to go back to Joe DiMaggio to find one like that.
Well, so, his 56-game hitting streak, nobody's come close to it.
I think that one's safe. So, David, you got out of the hospital at 16. I'm sure you wandered. I'm sure it was you didn't have an education. So I'm sure there was a time there where you were kind of just trying to figure out what you were going to do with your life. You ended up at a place called the Art Student League. Tell me quickly how you got there and how you became a professor there. That's an amazing story.
Well, at that time I was in advertising and I had no idea of being an artist or painting, but I would hang out in this coffee shop with a bunch of musicians who were friends of mine. I actually was rooming with two musicians who were going to Juilliard. And we would hang out at this coffee shop at night. And I would sketch, you know, people at the other tables or what was going on. And one of the waiters working there, Elias Rivera, would peek over my shoulders at my drawings. And eventually, we got into a conversation. Elias was already going to the Art Students League during the day and studying with Frank Mason. And in the course of our conversations, he said, I think you would like to study with Frank, you know, from what I had said to him. So one day I walked over to the Art Students League with Elias and I watched Frank teach and watched him demonstrate. And I thought, oh, this is sounds like a nice, good thing to learn. I'd like to learn to paint. So when I went off, I started collecting unemployment. I thought I would study painting as long as my unemployment ran out. And so after my unemployment ran out, I didn't feel like going back to work. So I decided I would put off going back to work as long as possible. And with Elias, we decided to go into the Greenwich Village Outdoor Art Show, which was a very big deal in those days. And see if I could make enough money that I didn't have to take another job. And I sold paintings in that first show. And then Elias and I got a loft in Little Italy, actually across the street from Frank Mason's loft. And so I kind of gradually got into it. I didn't really make a hard, fast decision that I was making a so-called career change. It was more like careening rather than careering. And it was just, we would sell, you know, try to sell paintings, do portraits of people or whatever, just to keep going to the next day, the next week, and so forth. So that's how I got started.
Well, you got started that way, but you actually, Frank Mason, who inspired you, he was on a sabbatical and they had you take over for him at the Art Student League. And then that's how it all eventually came about, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes.
That,
Which
I mean, that
was interesting because I had left Frank's class in quite a rage. He came in one day and worked on one of my paintings and to show off to a friend of his. And he messed up my painting. And I, when he left, I took it off the easel. I slashed it to ribbons, broke the stretcher bars over my knee, stomped out of the league and didn't come back. And he apologized a couple of years later in his fashion. And so when he asked me to take over his class, it was quite a surprise, but I had wanted to teach there, and that was my foot in the door, so to speak.
Well, it started a long, long history of time you spent there that was great, very valuable. And my sister, Sherry, actually, I think she met you in a class. Is that correct? That you were teaching?
Yes. She wandered in from Oklahoma City.
Well, I remember that. Go ahead. Yeah, I remember that last week before Sherry moved from Oklahoma to New York. And Sherry and I were literally, she was painting a painting of me just before we left. She never got it finished. I put her on the train. She went to New York City. And I mean, she left Oklahoma at that time. And I always kept that painting, the unfinished painting. And I just kept it all through the years. And then probably 12 or 13 years ago, she was back in Oklahoma, and 13 years ago, and I brought the painting out and she finished it and then signed it 1977/2008. So I've got probably the only painting that was started pre New York City for Sherry and post New York City. So that painting will be worth so much money someday. I'm holding on to that baby. But no, Sherry, obviously, when she was in your class and when she obviously was very inspired by the work you did. And so Art Student League is a big, big thing for her. It was a big part of her life. And I don't think either of your lives have been the same since. But if we can kind of transition from sort of New York City, how you got into painting to begin with. Your career took off and you obviously became a very, very well-known painter. And so you didn't know this, but through the years when you and I would have conversations, I would pick up on things that related to golf. I mean, totally related to coaching golf, playing golf, learning golf, teaching golf, any of that. And one of the things you said one time holds true with golf. And you said painting is just a problem-solving discipline. That's all it is. It's you look at a problem and then you solve it with strokes of the paintbrush or certain techniques or whatever. And talk about that, because that inspired me. That's all golf is. I hit a tee ball and I hit it someplace and I've created a problem with that tee ball. And now I have to figure out how I'm going to solve that. And every shot you hit in golf is a problem solving discipline. Tell me how it relates in painting.
Well, It's just, in a sense, Michael, it's the way you describe it. I think what happened up until roughly the 1840s, painting was taught as a problem-solving discipline. With the invention of the tin tube, which meant anybody could go into an art supply store and buy paint, it changed from a problem-solving discipline, in other words, the master-apprentice system. You would, you know, apprentice yourself to a master who would teach you how to paint, which means how to solve problems. But with the ability of anybody to buy a paint tube, it changed from that kind of a discipline to but it changed into a form of self-expression. So it developed a mystique. Modern art developed into a very kind of mystical, metaphysical process of people expressing themselves, what they were thinking of psychologically, etc. You needed art critics to explain paintings. It became verbal rather than visual. But in essence, as in anything in life, as you just mentioned, golf, life is a problem-solving discipline. So in painting, that's what it is. You learn the problems, how to make a flat surface look dimensional. That's the essential problem in painting, the quintessential, how to make a flat surface look real, so to speak. And there are essentially constraints, just like in golf and baseball, there were constraints with how to solve each particular problem. Now, each painter solves the problem according to their own background, psychology, etc. But understanding the problems, general problems, that's what makes painting unique.
Well, I agree with you. I think, and it's, by the way, it's what you can do and what Sherry can do. It I know when you think you would love to hit a 7-iron from 160 yards to 3 feet from the hole, I would love to make that blank canvas become something, and I can't do it. So it's amazing to watch it. But that gets me back to one of the best players I've ever coached, a guy named Pablo Martin. He was from Malaga, Spain. And one day I asked him, I said, Pablo, you're such a unique golfer because it's like you create something new every day. You're like an artist. And he said, you know, you're right. I am like an artist. And I said, well, tell me how. And he goes, well, every day I get to the golf course for a round of golf, the golf course becomes a blank canvas. And so what I have to do is create, hopefully, a masterpiece that day. And if I can do that, it's because of this stroke of the paintbrush and that stroke of the paintbrush, which for him was, I hit the tee ball with this 3-wood off the tee, and I'm going to carve it from left to right into the right center of the fairway. And if I do it just right, that's a perfect stroke of the paintbrush. If I don't do it just right, then I go up and I hit another shot, a recovery shot, and it's the next stroke of the paintbrush. He says, I just keep hitting the shots and stroking the paintbrush, and before you know it, I've got a work of art at the end of the day. Sometimes it's really good and sometimes it's not. So
exactly. What do
you, yeah. And I know you have bad painting days. Come on, please tell me you have them.
Yes. It's very similar to what he described, because every piece of paint you put down is related to the subsequent pieces of paint. So you're always honing your color, your values, which means how light or dark you're going, your edges, how hard or soft an edge is. So that's what always makes it exciting. Each painting, even though your intention is guiding you, all the little things along the way require the same adjustment that your golfer student mentioned, you see. So it's never cut and dry unless you have, you know, some painters just live on technique. So their results are always guaranteed. But that's not my way.
It's not as interesting that way, is it?
No. All I have as a guide is my intention. I want my finished work to look a certain way, come out a certain way. How I get there is up for grabs.
Okay. Can we just go right there? Because you led right into, I didn't expect you to, but you led right into the best quote I've ever gotten from you. And I don't know if you remember saying it, but I think you do. And you told me your technique should always follow your intention, not the other way around. And when you said that, I thought, that's the way you learn golf. That's the way you hit a golf shot. That's the way you teach golf. That's the way golf should be taught. So talk about that. Once again, I'll say it again. Your technique should always follow your intention, not the other way around. Explain that to a golfer.
Just what I finished before, Michael. If your technique is your master, then everything is guaranteed. There's no point in doing another painting because the result is guaranteed. Whereas if your intention is what drives your technique, you make up your technique. You don't have a technique. I've told so many students, I don't have a technique. I make it up as I go along. Like your golfer, a friend said, how you hit the ball, how you adjust to the lie, what club you're going to pick to adjust. So it's the same, exactly the same in painting. You make a few brush strokes and that, then you watch. You're watching what happens. It's not predetermined. So your painting is telling you what to do. I think the mistake a lot of painters, so-called painters, artists, they are aggressive, which means their technique is guiding them. With the way I approach it, I let my painting tell me what to do next. So I'm not copying what I'm looking at. I'm looking at my painting with my intention sort of swirling around in the back of my mind. And the painting is telling me which way to go. So it's a very receptive process rather than an aggressive process.
You know, you're mentioning that there's a guaranteed result when your technique drives it. In golf, everything's different. Every shot is different. Every contour of the golf course is different. The grass is higher or shorter one day or the next. The turf is firmer or softer. So it's so different. Just like you said, the painting there, it's driving your technique, the intention, where you want it to go. I think that's the way you hit golf shots. I really do. And it's when guys get so bound up in their technique that they don't end up with what they want. It never gets where they want. Honestly, it doesn't.
Yeah.
So I love that.
It's not alive.
It's not alive. You're so right. Gosh, I hope kids are listening to this. Perfectionism in golf training has a two-edged sword, double-edged sword for sure. So a guy who's a perfectionist, it'll probably drive him to work harder. He'll probably have a great work ethic. He'll probably try to get some skills honed in beautifully. But on the other hand, it's the most imperfect game in the entire world. And to be a perfectionist will drive you crazy in the game of golf. So I'm going to ask you this. I think I kind of know the answer, but I want to hear it from you. Painters can't be perfectionists, can they? And if they can't, why not?
Well, they're first in actuality, in the everyday world that we live in, there's no such thing as perfection. perfection being static, something that's never, never, ever changing. And in the real world, life is always moving. It's never static. Life means movement. So the idea of perfection is more, I would say, a psychological need of, because of insecurity on the person that's seeking perfection. So the insecurity wants you to have something unmoving, unchanging to strive for. So it's actually anti-life, but it's a psychological problem rather than an actual problem. So in painting, what makes a good painting is good solutions to the problems. In other words, if someone can paint or make a nose come out in 3 brush strokes, he understood the problem better than someone who took 15 brush strokes to make the same nose come out. So, and exactly how each person does it is, of course, as I said before, the individual person, how much color, lack of color, more color, edge change, becomes an individual. But in a good painting, what makes it good is the intelligence of the solutions, that someone who could see the elegant solutions cut to the heart of the matter makes that painting better than someone who has to stumble around, hunt, peck, and hope it comes out right.
Wow. Well said. So let me move a little bit toward this. I've always thought, you said make intelligent decisions. So in golf, you have to make intelligent, non-emotional decisions to be a good player. How does being really emotional affect your clarity in painting? Because in golf, when you are emotional, everything's cloudy. You can't make any good decisions and it ruins your game. In painting, if you walked into a painting and you are just extremely upset and emotional about something, are you as clear about your intention or about where you're going with painting that day?
On good days, of course, good days means clarity. And it's what people tend to think of emotionality, Michael, I think is more sentimentality. And it's a different kind of emotion when you're on than I've seen, you know, students where they kind of gyrate and they kind of falsely putting themselves in an emotional state. And as you just said, that kind of emotionality is really anti-clarity. When you see something clearly, for example, there's no choice, you're in the moment, there's no fake emotion or sentimentality, it's just clarity.
I love clarity. I mean, clarity to me allows a kid to make the right decision that's going to help benefit him in the game. And I've always told kids, you've made emotional decisions on the golf course and you've made clear-minded decisions on the golf course. You've never made a clear-minded emotional decision. They're apart from each other. So I just wondered how that affected painting. Sounds like it does a little bit. Relating it again to golf, especially to college golf, teammates are really important to you because they push you, they challenge you, they inspire you, they motivate you. It's great to be on a college golf team because the two best players in the team are always going to push each other, always. So you and Sherry are two very well-known, very accomplished, very talented artists. Do you push each other?
Well, do we help each other? Yes. I mean, Sherry does things in painting and drawing. She has a completely, not completely, but a very different approach to painting and to drawing. We did a drawing workshop last week and I watched her draw, and it was just amazing to see what she can do. But she does it completely differently. She holds her pencil differently than I do, you know, but at the core, we both are very similar. It's just because she's a different person than I am. She makes different brush strokes than I do, uses color differently, but it all comes out with the same intelligence. And there are times when I'm in a painting when she'll make a suggestion, and it's usually right on, very helpful. And I hope the same when I make a suggestion to her. So it's really a great relationship.
I think that's wonderful. And like I said, on my golf team, I don't care what technique a guy uses to get a result. But if somebody on the somebody else on the team can learn from him, I think it's great. And I think people who are striving for excellence, I mean, truly excellence, which I know both of you are, you both wake up every day thinking you're going to be a better painter or drawer than you were the day before. And here's why. Mainly it's attitude. And I think because you get up every day with that dream. So it's good to hear that you inspire each other and you motivate each other. There's somebody else who's inspired you a little bit in your career, and that would be a very famous painter named Rembrandt. I want to know how much effect his career or his work has had on yours, and discuss the most interesting part of painting to me, which is chiaroscuro. I want you to tell me about that or tell my listeners about that. But Rembrandt.
Well, the first time I ever went to a museum, when I was going to Parsons School of Design, it was the first time I had ever been inside a museum, Michael. And it was the Metropolitan, and there were the paintings by Rubens, Velázquez, Vermeer, Rembrandt, etc., you know, all the so-called great painters, and I thought they were all marvelous. But the way Rembrandt used light just struck me as different than anyone else in the rooms that I was visiting. His light seemed to have a quality, an inexorable quality. If it hit this place, then it naturally went to that place. And even though I couldn't fully understand it at the time, since, as I said, I actually was overwhelmed by everything, but it stayed with me until, you know, many years later, I would say roughly 10 years later, when I got interested in trying to learn to paint, that Rembrandt had this quality that chiaroscuro, how he used light, how he understood light, that no one else quite had that insight and clarity and intelligence that he had.
And it's affected your sort of, it's kind of pulled you along, or is it, it's had some influence on you through the years, I'm sure.
Well, yes. I mean, I did have an experience which I feel is akin somehow to what Rembrandt experienced. The famous story is when he was, I think, roughly 20 or 21, he was working in his father's mill, and he saw the light coming in from a window, and it struck him a particular way, that he saw light in a very particularly very famous story associated with him. And when I was a student at the Art Students League, I had a similar experience one day as a student. I was arguing with another woman in class, an older woman, and I was telling her she was very prejudiced, which I felt she was. And the class was about to start, and the monitor shushed me, you know, we're starting, it said. And I turned to the still life that I was going to paint that day, and I had what I must sort of felt, maybe, as people say, channeling Rembrandt. I looked at this still life, and all of a sudden, I saw light the way I had before. And it looked like water flowing over the objects. And it just changed, it's like water just changing color from egg color, which is what was in the egg color, to basket color, to drapery color. And it was the first time I had ever seen that kind of unity of light just flowing, and of course the shadow stopping it, and I was transfixed, so to speak. And I was afraid to move or blink my eyes, that it would go, disappear, go away. And that was the first, I should, that's when I first learned to paint or see the difference between light and shadow, instead of struggling and, you know, knowing it intellectually. I saw it for myself for the first time.
Wow. You've never told me that story. That's amazing. And it, a similar probably feeling that Rembrandt probably had at the time when he came to that realization.
Yeah, it was like looking through a hole, a rent in a curtain, and seeing a different kind of reality all of a sudden.
Well, thank you for sharing that. You know, you looked like it was a pretty emotional moment for you, obviously, at the time. And here you are, 91 years of age. And it occurs to me every time I talk to you that I don't see anybody anywhere at age 91 that has the same enthusiasm you have for your craft, the same enthusiasm for learning, the same enthusiasm just to get up and paint or do what you do well. Most people your age are in major cruise control. I mean, they are not busy trying to get better. What gets you up every day to get better at your craft? You're 91, David. That's amazing to be able to do that.
Well, for one, I have your sister driving me.
Okay, she, that makes it.
She keeps getting better as well.
If you don't get better, she'll pass you.
Yes. Well, if you don't, if there's no such thing, as I said, with perfection, Michael, there's no static. So if you don't get better, you get worse, because if you stay in the same place, then it just becomes boring. So, but there's always question in my mind, what don't I know? Or has my thinking become rigid? You know, what am I not seeing? Is there a better way to do this? So those questions are always driving me. What don't I understand? You see, could I see things differently, etc.? So those inchoate questions, you know, in the back of my mind, are what, and it's just fun picking up a piece of paint and putting it down on it. Just the sensual quality of it in and of itself has a lovely living quality to it.
Well, there's a Japanese term, Kaizen, K-A-I-Z-E-N, which is continuous self-improvement. And it's a Japanese term. And When I think of David LaFell, I think of that word because I think of somebody and enthusiasm, but I think of somebody who's never stopped learning. And I've coached against and watched a lot of coaches in their 60s and 70s who have kind of lost the desire to get any better. It's like, well, I'm kind of toward the end here. I can just mail it in. And I've never wanted to be one of those coaches. And I don't want any of my colleagues to become that. And you're the perfect example of how, yet even age 91, you're asking questions still. How could this be done better than I've been doing it? That's remarkable, David. And I think it's probably one of the reasons you've been so good for so long. Don't ever stop that.
Well, if you stop, they start throwing dirt over you.
You're right about that. That's the other thing I've always noticed about you is you have a great sense of humor. I don't think there's anything that keeps us younger other than I get to coach college athletes who are very young, which is great. But if you've got a great sense of humor and you see the fun part of life, you do stay younger. So don't ever change that either, David.
Well, life is too much fun to take serious.
Okay, I love it. Well, David, thank you so much for spending an hour with me today. This has been amazing. I think you've done a really good job of kind of letting a golfer know that there are other disciplines that relate to golf. And when you think about it, most of it is transferable. In other words, I think they overlap. I think the discipline to become a great painter is very similar to the discipline of becoming a great golfer or a great coach. There's certain things that kind of overlap, and you've done a great job of letting us know that today.
Well, as I said before, Michael, life is a problem-solving discipline. That's what life is. And as someone else said, human beings have a moral obligation to be intelligent.
Wow. Well said. Well said. Well, David, thank you. I would like to think that 25 years from now, you'll still be the best painter in the world. How about that? Don't stop. Don't stop.
I'll go for that.
Okay. All right. Be sure.
It's been a pleasure.
It has been a lot of fun. Thanks so much, David.